What's up? Welcome to the Plus Pitch Podcast, your morning starting pitcher podcast brought to you by PitcherList.com. My name is Jake Crumpler, and today is August 13th. Let's break down every single start from Wednesday, August 12th. We'll start it off with our first pitcher, Kyle Leahy, who appears to have turned a corner. We got our first look of him this season, and in that we saw a pitcher with a great arsenal, but he didn't really have the command. He was somebody who we labeled a piece, poor execution, awesome stuff, and that seemed to be the case throughout his first 14 starts. He pitched to a 4.63 ERA, a 1.57 whip, and just a 19% strikeout rate, but things are a little bit different. Now, hosting the Phillies, Leahy continued what has been an impressive hot streak, which culminated in five innings, one earned, six hits, no walks, and six strikeouts. Across his last nine starts, Leahy now has posted a 1.52 ERA with a sub-1 whip and a 25% strikeout rate, emerging as a starter that's worthy of our attention in the majority of fantasy leagues. And whenever a pitcher performs differently than their established baseline, we always have to ask the same questions. Has anything changed? What's changed? Will the changes stick? And is this level of performance sustainable? The answer is always a little bit nuanced, but that's what the roundup and the Plus Pitch podcast is for. Leahy already had great stuff, so we already knew he had the potential to succeed in the majors, but given the fact that he didn't succeed with his great stuff previously, we have to see concrete changes to believe in his new level. On the surface, there haven't really been any notable changes to Leahy's pitch mix or his strikeout indicators, like swinging strike rate. He's seen just a 1% increase to 11%. Maybe the 3% increase in his strike rate to an overall 65% mark accounts for the 3% decrease in his walk rate down to 5% during this hot streak. And it lines up with a 3% increase in his zone rate. So 3% more pitches in the zone, it leads to 3% more strikes. That seems to make sense. And maybe that also means 3% fewer walks, but without better command, I don't know if the control or it is really that improved. I guess he's finding the zone more, but batters aren't really punishing him for that. And that's not really enough to account for the 3-run drop in ERA. And as is typically the case, players need to get pretty lucky to go on runs like this. Leahy has been smiled upon by Koufax during his hot streak, checking on his hotel, his Holy Trinity, for equating luck. Leahy's BABIP has dropped from 346 to 282. His home run to fly ball ratio has dropped from 13% to 7%, and his left on base rate has risen from 77% to 91%. He's also reached two strikes 6% more often and put away batters 8% more often. All of that is clearly a change in fortune for Leahy, suggesting that not all of his success has been earned. There's a lot of luck, a lot of good fortune that's been going his way, but we're leaving out the best part when it comes to Leahy's hot streak. Some of that success is deserved. Leahy's been throwing harder, not by much, but enough to believe that the 13% increase in his weak contact rate might be a product of his pitches being more difficult to square up. He's also forcing batters to swing at these pitches because he's living in the zone more often. Four-seamers and sinkers are sitting closer to 95 miles per hour. Changeups are closer to 89 miles per hour, and curveballs are closer to 84 miles per hour. And only sliders and sweepers have experienced a velocity increase less than 0.7 miles per hour. They've been up 0.1 and 0.2 miles per hour, respectively. With top of the line 7.3 feet of extension on that four seamer, any bit of extra heat plays up that much more for Leahy. On Wednesday, Leahy once again relied heavily on favorable contact results as he induced single-digit whiffs for the fifth time during his nine-start hot streak. The strikeouts were once again a product of increased two-strike rates and put-away rates, and both of those marks were above his season-long baselines at 60% and 50% respectively. None of his pitches were located with any noticeable intent. He found the zone often, and he lived to tell the tale. I don't expect that to be the case often moving forward. Leahy's stuff is great, but without command improvements, it's hard to believe that a slight uptick in velocity could account for the weakened quality of contact and produce such a drastic improvement in his ratios, while the additional strikeouts are fully a product of unsustainable efficiency in an increased amount of two-strike counts. Leahy hasn't shaken that P's label, but he'll continue to roll. We will continue to roll with this Vargas rule, even as his schedule heats up. He heads to Cincinnati before heading to Philly and then getting the Pirates afterwards. And that may be a tough enough gauntlet to break him out of his rhythm, but it's worth taking the chance based on the recent results. Just be ready to jump ship as soon as the flowers start to wilt. Now let's look at every other starting pitcher from Wednesday. We'll start it off with Luis Castillo versus the Reds. 7 shutout innings, 1 hit, 2 walks, 10 strikeouts. He induced 22 whiffs and 36% CSW to earn the gallows pull. And this is not just a product of Castillo making his debut for the White Sox. He already had that and he struggled in that one. This might just be that he was facing his old ball club and he was a little bit fired up. He hasn't pitched for the Reds in a few years though. So this is really just a product of Castillo having impeccable command, which is something that's propelled him to success at certain points this year, but it's not something he's been reliable in producing consistently. He gets those fastballs upstairs. He gets the changeup low to left-handed batters. He dots that slider low and away to right-handed batters. And it's a beautiful approach, and it allowed him to rack up a season-high 10 strikeouts here. And if he could command like this every time, Castillo would be dope, but it's not a skill that he's proven to possess consistently, and he'll have to prove that he can maintain this feel on the north side of Chicago next before I can consider Castillo against the Mets and in Minnesota afterwards. Next, we have Adrian Hauser versus the Astros. 6 shutout innings, 2 hits, 1 walk, 5 strikeouts. And Hauser has excelled since getting moved to the bullpen at the end of June. This was actually his first start back in the rotation, but it continued a stretch of 10 outings during which he's pitched to a 1.70 ERA and a 0.86 whip. The strikeouts still aren't here, 16% during that hot streak, but that's not something Hauser's ever provided. He doesn't really need the fancy strikeouts if he's sitting 96 miles per hour as he did on Wednesday and throughout the hot streak. That velocity allows his fastball to live in the zone and avoid damage, leading to plenty of weak contact and plenty of outs on balls in play. Obviously, Hauser's not going to keep up the 204 BABIP that he's had since moving to the bullpen, but we don't need him to have a sub-2 ERA to make him viable in fantasy leagues. He should be rostered in deeper leagues at the moment, and he's a streaming option as a Toby in standard leagues in Cleveland next. Now we have Tatsuya Imai in San Francisco. 3 shutout innings, 3 hits, 2 walks, 3 strikeouts. He was pitching in bulk relief after Brian King opened for him. And this was the second outing of a trio of scoreless frames from Imai. I'm not sold that seeing him come out of the bullpen makes me any more confident. Maybe if they did the closer entrance for Imai, I might get a little bit pumped up, but they're not going to do that for any old bulk reliever. And it hasn't come with the corresponding increase in velocity that you hope to see from a starter when they transition to the bullpen. I'd say in leagues where your starts are limited and bulk relievers are basically free points, then by all means, send Imai out there at will. It's not worth the blow up potential in standard leagues. Next, we have Dustin May in San Diego. 7 innings, 1 earned, 4 hits, 2 walks, 6 strikeouts. And the Brewers are having May lean into his cutter more and cut back on 4-seamers. I think it's a smart development as the cutter at 93 miles per hour is a weapon versus both lefties and righties. And it allows the 4-seamer to act as a surprise put-away pitch upstairs if May was able to get it up there. The primary cutter fastball dominated with 8 whiffs, 40% CSW, and 70% strikes, splitting the zone with sinkers versus right-handed batters as the cutter landed away and the sinker jammed righties, which is an approach that I absolutely adore. And he used the cutter to jam left-handed batters. It's an approach overall versus both batters that allows May to produce a bunch of weak contact, which means quick outs in play with a great defense behind him, allowing him to pitch 7 complete innings with just 83 pitches. It's not my favorite thing to see reduced velocity and diminished movement across the board from May, but doesn't seem to have affected his ability to dominate that much. I love his new home, and I expect him to be a reliable Holly the rest of the season. Next, we have Eric Lauer versus the Royals. 6 1/3 innings, 1 earned, 4 hits, 2 walks, 6 strikeouts. And Lauer got us our dub and piqued our interest in the process with 1-2 extra ticks across the board. I don't know if this was like his attempt at securing his role in the rotation. He definitely feels the pressure with the return of Blake Snell and with Tyler Glasnow's return on the horizon, but this sure looks like the Dodgers having him empty the tank as he racked up 112 pitches. And with that big workload, that sort of takes away a bit from the 19 whiffs, but still impressive from a guy like Lauer who hasn't been much of a whiff machine this year. So maybe the Dodgers were just having him empty the tank before they move him to the bullpen, sort of take some pressure off of the bullpen while Lauer still pitching as a starter. I think regardless, though, if he sticks around for another week, he heads to Coors next. So it's not a start I'm interested in. So if you're holding on to Lauer right now, I'd be letting him go. Next, we have Tyler Molly versus the Mets. 6 innings, 1 earned, 4 hits, no walks, 7 strikeouts. And Molly's making quite the first impression in Atlanta. That's 2 6-inning starts with 1 or fewer runs while racking up 16 strikeouts. However, the 93 to 94 mile per hour velocity that got us interested in the first place and supported Molly's recent improvements was nowhere to be found on Wednesday. He sat 92 to 93 miles per hour, hitting 94 miles per hour just once. That is not a good sign. And his command made up for it with 4 seamers living upstairs and everything landing away to right-handed batters, while splitters absolutely dominated left-handed batters downstairs with 7 whiffs. Molly will head to Minnesota next, and that's not an intimidating enough start for me to avoid him without the velocity. But if he's missing that velocity again in Minnesota, I think we have to let him go. We saw how much he struggled in San Francisco when he was below 93 miles per hour on average. Next, we have Jansen Jung versus the Pirates. A tough matchup, but he tossed 6 innings of 1-run ball, allowing 4 hits and 1 walk while striking out 2. And it's so impressive how someone with such great stuff can struggle to miss bats the way that Jung has done this year. That's 10 straight starts with single-digit whiffs and a combined 5 whiffs across his last 3 starts. I mean, there's like no pitcher in baseball doing that right now, even among the guys that you think of as the low strikeout arms, the guys that are very pitch to contact. But that's what Junk's been. And the weirdest part of it all is that he's been able to remain decently successful through this bout of lack of whiffs. Similar to Leahy, Junk has stuff that's good enough that it's difficult to hit when it finds the zone, but despite living in the zone and paying monthly rent there, he somehow finds a way to produce enough weak contact, 70% weak contact on Wednesday from Junk. And he does that enough that he deserves some of the fortunate batted ball results. Unfortunately, I cannot put the fate of my fantasy team in the hands of someone so reliant on contact. I think Junk is somebody who might be a sleeper for 2027. It's just not coming together this year. Next, we have Jose Soriano versus the Red Sox. 6 innings, 1 earned, 4 hits, 2 walks, 4 strikeouts. The improved defense behind Soto in his new home north of the border is sort of a godsend for a ground ball pitcher. He returned 12 outs on 15 balls in play thanks to 15% grounders on Wednesday, with the only damage coming against him on a solo shot by Wilson Contreras off of a curveball that he hung to end a 9-pitch battle. That curveball, I think, is going to be the key to unlocking his long dormant strikeout potential. I've been comparing Soriano to Framber Valdez all year, and he's somebody whose success is reliant on how good his curveball is on any given night. But Soriano's curveball is going to need to do better than 54% strikes on Wednesday to unlock that strikeout potential. After the Blue Jays asked, I don't know how they got it done, but they told Soriano, yo, throw your curveball as much as possible. He threw it more than ever in his Blue Jays debut, but they flipped the script and he threw curveballs at his lowest rate of the season on Wednesday. I think they got to pick a side or something. I need to see some sort of approach from Soriano that suggests that the Blue Jays are trying to get the most out of him, or that they know what to do to get the most out of him. That doesn't seem to be the case at this point. I love the fastball locations. His splitter command was great, but I just wondered what the Blue Jays are trying to do to get the most out of Soriano. There's definitely potential there, but there's also potential for negative regression. He's a guy who struggles with his command and is heavily reliant on balls in play at the moment. Next, we have Foster Griffin in Detroit. 5 innings, 1 earned, 4 hits, 1 walk, 3 strikeouts. And the heights of June and July are in the rearview mirror for Griffin. He's now finding that his kitchen sink approach is much more hittable, making him heavily reliant on the new teammates positioned behind him to turn batted balls into outs. Griffin's been unable to miss bats without his peak velocity that we saw in June, nor the command that allowed him to jam right-handed batters with his cutters and land changeups low. And with 4 seamers failing to turn this into a cannonball, McSanchez mixing with cutters upstairs, Griffin is looking a lot more like a Toby rather than the elite Holly he was in the middle of the summer, which makes him somebody in most standard leagues that you can let go if there's somebody better on the wire. Next, we've got Cal Quantrill in LA against the Angels. 5 innings, 1 earned, 4 hits, 3 walks, 6 strikeouts. And he's not called the unquantifiable for nothing. I literally have no idea what to do with Cal Quantrill. There's no reason to believe that his splitter-heavy approach will lead to many more starts like this, but he keeps one-upping himself. I don't think it's going to keep working because I don't think Quantrill stuff is that good. And because he's so reliant on a splitter, it's a volatile pitch. So I'd expect his results to be volatile. And they have been throughout his career. He's just doing pretty well. He's doing well enough recently. It was a season high 6 punchouts on Wednesday from Quantrill as he rode his splitty to 8 whiffs and 4 strikeouts, thanks to a 60% overall put away rate, which is clearly unsustainable. I hope that Nathan Eovaldi can come back soon so that we don't have to deal with trying to figure out what is up with Cal Quantrill moving forward. Next, we have Ranger Suarez in Toronto. 5 innings, 1 earned, 6 hits, 1 walk, and 2 strikeouts. The Park Ranger is back in that little booth where they make you go to pay to see nature. I always think that's sort of stupid. I understand how the parks work, that they need public funding to make sure that we can have our parks, our national forests, et cetera. But what are tax dollars for? Don't get me started on politics. That's not what this podcast is for. And yeah, I might sound a little upset. So maybe this is not the best analogy to talk about Ranger Suarez's return to being a trustworthy option now that he's exceeded 80 pitches and is commanding his stuff effectively. The whiffs will come as he continues to recover the feel for his arsenal. He had just 6 whiffs and 2 strikeouts here, but that has been eluding him during his return from injury. But Suarez is somebody who, when he's on, and it lasts for a while. I think he's probably going to get there in his next start, and he's definitely somebody you want to start moving forward. Next, we'll talk about Mason Black, George Klaassen, Rhett Lauder, Drew Rasmussen, and the rest of the pitchers that appeared on Wednesday. But first, we're going to take a quick break here on the Plus Pitch Podcast. And we're back. Jake Crumpler here on the Plus Pitch Podcast discussing every starting pitcher from Wednesday. Mason Black pitched in Los Angeles against the Dodgers. 3 innings, 1 earned, 3 hits, 2 walks, and 1 strikeout. He was the follower behind Daniel Lynch, who opened with 2 1/3 innings, 3 earned, 3 hits, no walks, and 3 strikeouts. And I'm really not a fan of the Royals moving Lynch back to the rotation after all his struggles there and all his success in the bullpen this year. This was a guy who had like a 14% strikeout rate as a starter, but has been an excellent reliever for the Royals this year. They don't have a strong bullpen either. I don't know why they're doing this. I guess it worked with Chris Bubich last year, but I really don't trust the Royals pitching development, nor do I trust their manager's bullpen uses, but you really don't want to get me started on Matt Cotraro. As for Mason Black, he went for 2 whiffs on 44 pitches against the Dodgers, and he doesn't appear trusted to throw more than 50 pitches. He's done that just once in his 14 outings. And with Lynch replacing him as a bulk option or as a guy in the rotation, it'll only be a matter of time before Lynch is completely stretched out and won't need Black to follow him. So Black is somebody who becomes irrelevant pretty soon. Next, we have George Klaassen versus the Rangers. 6 innings, 2 earned, 5 hits, 1 walk, 5 strikeouts. And Klaassen walked 14 batters in his first 3 big league starts, but he finally found enough of the zone on Wednesday to show what his great stuff is capable of. He throws 96, and he has had the ability to go 97, 98 miles per hour with the fastball. The slider is dope, and those two pitches combined for 73% strikes, meaning he did not need much help from his changeup in terms of finding the zone. It could be a pitch that he just kept away from left-handed batters to hunt for whiffs. And there wasn't much of approach other than filling up the zone with that 1-2 punch and landing those changeups away from left-handed batters. And honestly, that game plan could work, as all he really needs to do is throw enough strikes, but it might make him a little bit home run prone as he looks to keep pitches out of the heart of the zone. I think Klaassen is somebody to consider in deeper leagues, though I sort of want to see it one more time. And I'm not totally opposed to taking a chance in Houston next. Rhett Lauder did all he could in Chicago on the south side against the White Sox, tossing 5 1/3 innings, allowing 2 earned runs with 7 hits and 1 walk and 4 strikeouts. And Rhett Lauder reminds me of Rhett and Link, one of my favorite YouTubers, and don't think I'm a bandwagoner. And they've gotten pretty big recently, but I've been watching Rhett and Link for like 15 years at this point. Regardless, Lauder is your prototypical Toby who can take down bottom half offenses. The White Sox are ranked 15th in WRC plus versus right-handed pitchers, so this was about as borderline as it gets. And Lauder sort of made it work, but this was a dusty donut with 8 base runners, and it would have been nice if he earned a win too. And I don't sound very happy about this. And I mean, this is what we should expect from a low level Toby. It won't blow your socks off, but it's got some benefits to it. Sort of like coconut water, which my girlfriend enjoys, but it's not something that I am pouring myself many glasses of. Next, we have Drew Rasmussen in Sacramento. 5 innings, 2 earned, 4 hits, 1 walk, 3 strikeouts. And Ace is going to survive Sacraverde despite sitting 1-2 ticks down and struggling to miss bats. It's hard to complain with the results. We just wish we had a few more strikeouts and some more confidence that Rasmussen isn't going to start regressing without that velocity. Make sure you're streaming your high upside setup men to make up for starts like this one throughout the week. Dylan Lee is a great option because he's a guy who's going to get you those strikeouts throughout the week. Grant Taylor is another one who's not rostered everywhere because he doesn't get a bunch of saves, but those type of guys sort of sprinkled throughout your roster will make up for starts like these, and they'll combine to make your ratios even better. You get 3 shutout innings with like 6 strikeouts. That's dope. That's going to make this 5-inning, 3 strikeout outing and 8-inning, 9 strikeout outing just out of nowhere. Man, Rick Graham would be so proud of me if he could see me right now talking about relievers on the Plus Pitch podcast. Next, we have Ryan Feltner in Arizona. 5 innings, 2 earned, 7 hits, 3 walks, and 2 strikeouts. And even freed from Coors, Feltner had a mediocre performance on the road. The Colorado triple whammy, I think, is really tough. One, you have to pitch in Denver. Two, there's the hangover effect that you get when you leave the altitude in Coors. And then three, the Rockies pitching development fails to maximize your potential. There's hope that the new front office in Colorado can work on changing those narratives, and maybe Feltner can be a guy in the future that we can trust. But I think this is going to be something down the line, like maybe 3 years from now, that we could start seeing changes in. But I think by that point, Feltner is either going to be on another team or out of baseball altogether if he keeps pitching like this when he's on the road. Next, we have Robbie Ray versus the Brewers. 4 innings, 2 earned, 2 hits, 3 walks, 4 strikeouts. And welcome to the torture show, Padres fans. Giants fans are very used to it, having experienced the high anxiety 9th innings of the Beard Brian Wilson that he put them through during the three-peat dynasty. And they sort of got reintroduced to the torture with Ray's high walk act. At least the Padres are looking to combat his stressful ways, and Ray is executing that game plan. Sliders away at 61% usage to lefties, with changeups away to right-handed batters at 46% usage. His command was pretty decent of those two pitches, but he's still throwing sinkers more often than four-seamers to right-handed batters, which that doesn't make any sense to me. And he issued a trio of 3-2 count walks. That's 8 walks now across his first 9 innings with the Padres. And Robbie Ray will have to improve the 27% put away rate that he had on Wednesday to finish off at bats and find the efficiency that he needs to allow him to reach the 6th frame. I've got faith in him. The command is looking good. I think there's just some kinks to iron out as he transitions to these new threads in San Diego. Next, we have Zach Thornton in Atlanta. 6 innings, 3 earned, 7 hits, 1 walk, 2 strikeouts. It's still just cutters and 4 seamers with minimal assistance from sliders from Thornton. He found enough outs in play to record a poor quality start, but everyone that is not in a quality start league is complaining about this outing because the ratios are terrible and he produced just 2 strikeouts. Thornton's had just 1 start with double-digit whiffs in his career. This season has been his career, and I really don't see a path to Thornton producing a ceiling that's worth chasing in the majority of leagues. Next, we have David Peterson in our nation's capital. 5 innings, 3 earned, 9 hits, 3 walks, and 6 strikeouts. Peterson's command has been massively improved since being dealt, and I honestly love his situation as a Toby in front of baseball's best defense. Tobies are going to have lower strikeout rates, which means they're going to be more reliant on batted balls finding gloves, and that's something that the Cubs excel at. But it just didn't come together here. The Southpaw got singled out despite that elite defense behind him. It was a 500 BABIP, and I really think this is going to be better against the White Sox next, as long as Peterson maintains his newfound ability to get great pitch separation on his 5-pitch mix. Next, we have Jackson Kent versus the Cubs. He made his MLB debut tossing 4 innings with 3 earned runs, 3 hits, 5 walks, and 6 strikeouts. And while it didn't go well, I could see him figuring it out in due time. Kent displayed a poorly shaped 92-93 mile per hour four-seamer that plays up a lot thanks to elite 7 feet of extension. He paired it with an effective slider to left-handed batters low and away, and a dope changeup to right-handed batters that he kept low, as well as a curveball that he's looking to steal free real estate State with. It's a recipe that's got swatch written all over it, southpaw with a tight changeup. And as long as Kent rids himself of the debut jitters, allowing him to throw more than the 47% overall strikes we saw on Wednesday, Kent should become relevant, akin to the likes of fellow young swatches Jake Bennett and Ian Seymour. Next, we have Framber Valdez versus the Guardians. 5 2/3 innings, 4 earned, 6 hits, 5 walks, and 3 strikeouts. The high four-seamers from his last start were just a one-start blip, and Valdez is back to going sinker-heavy with curveballs acting as the X-factor. The hook was fine here, but despite throwing 63% overall strikes, Valdez struggled to wrangle his control all game. He walked the leadoff batter, plunked the third batter he faced, walked a batter in each of the fourth and fifth, and then issued 2 more free passes in the sixth inning. We've seen him post high walk rates in the past, but rarely has it come without the elite stretch of starts that makes him worth rostering for a whole season. We've seen that in the past every single year from Framber. He has these one-off outings, these weeks or pair of weeks where he struggles, but overall he goes on like a 2-month run where he's absolutely elite, and that makes his season-long line look great, makes him great in points leagues and roto leagues. But in those head-to-head category leagues, he can be pretty frustrating, and at this point in the season he's running out of time to make that hot streak happen. And to be honest, I'd be looking elsewhere in standard head-to-head category leagues. Next, we have Zach Wheeler in St. Louis. 5 innings, 4 earned, 6 hits, 1 walk, 5 strikeouts. And Ace is going to continue to make us anxious. That's a 7.63 ERA across Wheeler's last 4 starts, as his velocity has fluctuated between averaging 93.5 miles per hour and 95.3 miles per hour, a range that is clearly well below the 96 plus we saw from him when he was at his best. Wheeler's command is still excellent, which allows him to be somebody that I think we want to keep starting. And this start can be blamed on a 38% left on base rate and getting singled out in the fifth. So a lot of bad luck in the fifth inning, and he was unable to strand the 7 runners that he allowed on base. I'm still sending Wheeler out there with no questions asked against the Marlins, but I'd really love to see him dominate so we can stop worrying about a potential injury, either get that fastball velocity north of 96 or have a big strikeout outing, or maybe 6 shutout innings would be great, Wheeler. Thank you very much. Next, we have Zebby Matthews versus the Orioles. 5 innings, 4 earned, 6 hits, 2 walks, and 4 strikeouts. And Matthews really hasn't given us many reasons to think about him other than to be jealous of his 80 grade first name. I mean, Zebby Crumpler sounds amazing. But unfortunately, his given name is Daniel. I see why he switched away from that one. Nothing against any Daniel. I got a lot of friends named Daniel. It just doesn't have that same ring to it as Zebby. However, that nickname doesn't come from nowhere. Matthew's middle name is Zebulon, and that is super dope. And that might be the middle name of my future child. Next, we have Carbon Majinski in Miami. 2 1/3 innings, 4 earned, 5 hits, 3 walks, and a strikeout. And with Mitch Keller on the IL, Majinski is getting another shot in the rotation. I was not a fan the first time, as his approach was heavily reliant on a volatile splitter, and that splitter returned just 50% strikes on Wednesday, while the rest of his arsenal went sub 60% strikes. So not enough strikes here, led to 3 walks, 3 times as many walks as strikeouts. And the whiffs aren't there either, just 3 whiffs across nearly 3 frames. 3 whiffs across 59 pitches is a better way to put that. And there's really nothing to get excited about here with Majinski. Let's check back in when he's increased his workload beyond 80 pitches, but I doubt my opinion will change by then. Next, we have Bryce Miller in New York. 6 innings, 5 earned, 8 hits, 1 walk, 5 strikeouts against the Yankees. Miller becoming a primary splitter pitcher was not on my 2026 bingo card, and I cannot say I'm a fan of it either. He's supposed to be dominating with his beautifully shaped four-seamer and utilizing a wide swath of secondaries that include sliders and splitters to prop up that amazing fastball. That has not been the case for Miller recently, as he struggled without the elite velocity with which he opened the season. There is a silver lining that Miller returned to 96 plus miles per hour here for the first time since June, but that does not change the fact that he's pitched to a 6.12 ERA and a 15% strikeout rate across his last 6 starts. Those bone chips in his elbow might be a serious problem, and I'd be stashing Cade Anderson everywhere. Next, we have Will Warren versus the Mariners. 4 innings, 5 earned, 6 hits, 4 walks, 3 strikeouts. And without a secondary pitch stepping up to support his declining fastballs, Warren's experienced a precipitous decline throughout his season and in terms of his results. He needs to have that changeup or the sweeper step up because the IVB has been falling on his four-seamer. That sinker is not a spectacular pitch, and I've linked Warren to Emerson Hancock all year, and their seasons have sort of been parallels all year. I expect Warren to head to the bullpen when Carlos Rodon returns to health instead of Ryan Weathers, whose approach I have been believing in more as he's relied more heavily on his secondary stuff so that his fastballs don't get turned around for so many home runs. And I think Warren's going to be a key member of the relief staff in the postseason as this shallow Yankees arm barn gets pushed to its limits. There's really not much behind David Bednar and Fernando Cruz. Next, we have Shane Baz in Minnesota. 3 innings, 5 earned, 9 hits, 1 walk, and 2 strikeouts. And what the heck? Baz lost 2 ticks of velocity to sit 94 miles per hour on his four-seamer, and he didn't pull back on it at all. He just kept throwing those four-seamers, and it just did not work out for him. Let's hope this was just a one-night bland from Baz and not necessarily a sign of something that's wrong with him, that he's going to continue throwing 94 miles per hour. His command was fine here, but everything was just too hittable, with batters not having to worry about being blown away by those fastballs at 96-plus miles per hour. Second to last, we have Jack Perkins versus the Rays. 5 innings, 6 earned, 12 hits, 1 walk, and 2 strikeouts. And Perkins is a strikeout upside play that we avoid when he's pitching at home in Sacre Verde. This was in Sacramento, so we left him on our wires, or at least I hope you did. The strikeouts are not worth chasing when you have the threat to the ratios that Perkins presents. Lastly, we have Merrill Kelly versus the Rockies. 5 innings, 6 earned, 6 hits, 3 walks, and 2 strikeouts. And I cannot tell if Kelly is good or bad. He goes on just mini streaks, 2 to 3 starts at a time of doing really well and then doing really poorly. Kelly survived the Dodgers last time, and then he gets blown up by Rocky Road. It just makes him too difficult to predict if he's doing that, if he's succeeding against the baseball's best team and then struggling against the worst team. It also doesn't help that he's throwing 1 to 2 ticks slower and hasn't really displayed anything to support his changeup. And I don't think he's really worth rostering when you combine all that stuff, when you can't predict when to start him and when you're not even guaranteed that he's going to do well against one of the weakest offenses. I would avoid Kelly in Boston next, but consider him a deep league Toby moving forward. Looking forward, my game of the day is Logan Gilbert versus Max Fried. We've got a pair of aces squaring off, and it really doesn't get much better than that. But that'll do it for this episode of the Plus Pitch Podcast. Make sure to head on over to pitcherlist.com to read the article that accompanies this podcast, the SP Roundup. I'll be with you throughout the rest of the weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, for podcast posting on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You can catch me on the SP Roundup. You can catch me on the Plus Pitch Podcast. You can catch me on the First Pitch Podcast. You can catch me on the In the Pen Podcast. You can follow me on socials at Jake Crumpler, where I do accompanying tweets with these daily SP streamers and breaking down every single start, the pitcher list, stats, player cards. But you can find all of my work at crumplerbaseball.com. But that's every single starting pitcher from Wednesday. We'll talk to you tomorrow.